there's a fear about among the Rohingya that if they do go back, they would be essentially locked down in internally displaced persons camps.
The Rohingya in Bangladesh make a decision to return to Myanmar. This is Friday, August 23rd, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melbourne in Washington. Also ahead, protests in Hong Kong continue to bring about some strong emotions on many sides. North Korea says recent moves by the United States could trigger a new Cold War. And the U.S.-China trade spat is good news for some other countries. It all comes your way on today's VOA Asia. None of the thousands of Rohingya Muslims living in crowded refugee camps in Bangladesh turned up for a planned repatriation to Myanmar Thursday, demanding they first be guaranteed safety and citizenship. Bangladesh Refugee Commissioner Abu Kalam told reporters not a single Rohingya wants to go back without their demands being met. About 700,000 ethnic Rohingyas fled Myanmar for Bangladesh 2 years ago following a brutal military crackdown that in northwest Rakhine State. But for more than 120,000 Rohingya who remained in Myanmar, life is grim and many fear for their future. Myanmar's government says it wants to close the camps for these internally displaced Rohingya, but they'll not be allowed to return to the homes they had fled. From reporting done in Myanmar's Rakhine State, VOA has this report narrated by Catherine Gibson.
This is among the 18 camps where 120,000 Rohingya and other displaced Muslims have had to live after their homes were razed by Buddhist mobs. Denied citizenship, the Rohingya live in prison-like conditions with no access to health care, work, or education. Women and girls are especially affected by restrictions. They face daily struggles because of the acute hygiene and sanitation conditions.
For us, living in camps is very difficult. Camp conditions easily affect our health, but here it's very difficult to get medical treatment. No doctors are available. If a pregnant woman faces difficulties delivering a baby and needs to look for a clinic, she can lose her baby.
Myanmar's de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi and her government say they are acting on recommendations handed down by the International Advisory Kofi Annan Commission. These include investing in infrastructure to help lift both the Rohingya and Buddhist communities out of poverty. But the Rohingya and human rights groups have slammed the government for its current policy that they say only entrenches segregation and does not focus on talks about citizenship. Authorities are currently building permanent housing next to camp fences and in some flood-prone areas. Struggling to survive the bleak conditions in camps, some women are so desperate for their children to go to school that they will trade their ration cards to other refugees in the camps and go without food.
Living in the camp is like living in a prison or a chicken coop. It's not appropriate for teenagers, married parents, and elders to live inside a small room.
Many mothers say their one hope is for their children to live peacefully in the community again. Catherine Gibson, VOA News.
As far as the decision by the Rohingya not to return to Myanmar, I spoke with Phil Robertson. He is Deputy Director of Human Rights Watch's Asia Division.
The two sides, you know, have been looking over this list of 22,000 refugees. Myanmar looked at it and said, we have no objection to approximately 3,500 coming back. The key issue here is that the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, is involved, and UNHCR has been saying all along that the time and the conditions are not right for people to return. There's no international monitoring. There's no protection. There's no freedom of movement. There's no guarantee of citizenship rights. All the things that, frankly, would need to be in place for the Rohingya to be protected, to be secure, and to return in dignity are not there. And the Rohingya are not prepared yet to go either because they say they would essentially be going back to the same sort of situation under the control of the military and police that harmed them so badly just 2 years ago. So, you know, but Bangladesh wants these people to go back. Myanmar wants to impress upon the international community that they are being fair and even-handed in considering them going back.
Human Rights Watch has said that the conditions in Rakhine State are not conducive for voluntary, safe, or dignified repatriation. How do you know that, and what would they face if they did decide to go back?
Well, it's quite clear that it is not safe for them to go back at this time. That's why we have called for this repatriation exercise to be suspended until there is actually a real improvement on the ground inside Rakhine State. What we see is the following. First of all, if they did go back, there's no guarantees that they would have international monitors or humanitarian agencies able to get access to them on a consistent basis to make sure they were okay. Second of all, there's been no accountability for the military and police that committed the violations against the Rohingya, which included crimes against humanity and possibly genocide. So they're basically going back into the clutches of the same security forces that harmed them so grievously. Third, there is no guarantees of freedom of movement, citizenship rights, access to livelihoods or services, the sort of things that the Rohingya say that they need to be able to go back. And fourth, and perhaps most importantly, there's no guarantee that they would actually be able to return to their original homes or their original villages. In many cases, we have seen via satellite imagery that the Myanmar government and military has been bulldozing abandoned Rohingya villages, have been using them for other purposes. And so there's a fear among the Rohingya that if they do go back, they would be essentially locked down in internally displaced persons camps, similar to the 128,000 Rohingya who have been in these kind of lockdown, internally displaced person camps since 2012. I mean, there's over 128,000 who, you know, don't enjoy freedom of movement, who are dependent on international aid for their basic survival. And a fear that if they, travel outside that area, that they would face persecution and abuse and worse from the security forces or from ethnic Rakhine.
Well, these people, the Bangladesh, who are now living in Bangladesh, the Rohingya living in Bangladesh, how much better is the conditions under which they are living, and Bangladesh doesn't want them there anymore? They're like people without a country.
Well, that's certainly true. The situation in the camps is not a good one. The Bangladesh authorities have, in our view, really restricted the Rohingya's right to education, to shelter that is really something that could stand up to a significant storm that would, you know, allow them to live safely there. I mean, there's a whole bunch of restrictions on their right to work, their ability to leave the camps. All these things are very serious, but ultimately they are not being surrounded by Myanmar police and military who, you know, just 2 years ago were involved in raping and massacring Rohingya. So, if the choice is to stay in a refugee camp in Bangladesh where you're at least safe versus going back into Myanmar to an uncertain future where you may be essentially handing your lives back to the same people that abused you so badly just 2 years ago, people are going to wait in the refugee camp and make sure the situation improves and the what's on offer in Rakhine State is better before they decide to go back.
Phil Robertson of Human Rights Watch joined us via Skype from Bangkok. These are among the top Asia stories you'll find right now at voanews.com. The United States and the Afghan Taliban resumed peace talks in Qatar to try to conclude an agreement that would bring an end to the longest U.S. overseas military intervention. In an escalation of its bitter dispute with Japan, South Korea decided Thursday to scrap a military intelligence sharing agreement with Tokyo, opening a new divide in trilateral security cooperation among the U.S., Japan, and South Korea. China's embassy in Canada said Thursday that bilateral ties were suffering gross difficulties and demanded that Ottawa free Huawei Technology Company Limited Chief Financial Officer Meng Wanzhou. Reports say the jet fuel supply to state-run carrier Air India has been stopped at 6 domestic airports because of unpaid dues to its fuel provider. This is VOA Asia. We continue. Protests continue in Hong Kong, both confrontational and quiet, as activists employ a wide range of strategies to spread their pro-democracy message. Michael Sullivan has more from Hong Kong.
A subway station protest, which led to a standoff Wednesday, brought together diverse members of the city's population.
I am joining with other Hong Kongers, people in Hong Kong. We are aligned in that we need to make changes. The majority of Hong Kong people, at least 60% of us, are democratic in our views.
Thursday, students mobilized, some advocating a school boycott in September.
We hope that this is a better way of struggle to prevent the attack from the police and the gangsters. And we think that when the students go on strike, it will give more confidence to workers to go on strike also.
Finding sympathetic listeners afraid Hong Kong will lose its special status.
If people now do not connect together, the communists are coming. They are just trying to make one country work. Two systems, no.
Wednesday, a small demonstration at the British consulate demanded that China release a British consular worker detained in the mainland. Another example, they say, of Beijing's overreach.
It is already a global, an international issue. So I think that the UK government should voice out more about this.
People leave messages on walls, known as Lennon Walls, after musician John Lennon, demanding safeguards for Hong Kong's way of life.
I don't think the government is going to do anything except to drag his feet. It is unfortunate that it hasn't met any of the demands, the five demands that have been written on the wall, the Lennon Wall, throughout the territory in Hong Kong. So I don't think it's going to end soon.
There is no shortage of commitment.
The world is watching us, and we all know that freedom is needed, and we need to fight for freedom as well as the human rights.
Protesters say they'll keep working however they can to get out their message. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Hong Kong.
Happening now in Asia, the United States Thursday sharpened its criticism of China's activities in the disputed areas of the South China Sea, slamming an escalation in efforts to intimidate other claimants like Vietnam. China redeployed a government-owned survey vessel with armed escorts into the waters off Vietnam earlier this month, according to the United States. This is VOA Asia. A North Korean spokesman said Thursday the United States' recent testing of mid-range cruise missiles, along with plans to deploy fighter jets and military equipment around the Korean Peninsula, could trigger a new Cold War in the region. On the government website, the spokesman said that North Korea remains unchanged in its position to resolve all issues through dialogue and negotiation, but dialogue accompanied by military threats is of no interest to us. North Korea's stance comes the day after the U.S. envoy to North Korea, Stephen Biegun, said the Trump administration was ready to resume working-level talks on nuclear negotiations following the second summit between Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un. In addition, Seoul announced it will end an intelligence-sharing pact with Japan, a decision that could further escalate a dispute over history and trade and undercut security cooperation on North Korea. VOA International Edition host Steve Miller spoke with Oba Miller, a former Obama cabinet secretary. He was asked about the prospects of talks between the United States and North Korea.
Well, we're at a pivotal moment in U.S.-North Korea diplomacy, between a moment of tension caused by the diplomatic impasse we've had so far and U.S.-ROK combined military exercises, and a moment of opportunity created by those exercises ending and the time pressure to get some sort of agreement by the end of the year. So I do see some prospect for diplomacy between the United States and North Korea moving forward in the coming months. But at the same time, I'd caution that the really fundamental issues that brought the two countries to an impasse, such as defining denuclearization or the extent of sanctions relief, have really not been resolved yet.
You mentioned that there is an opportunity. What makes this opportunity different than, say, the last few years of trying to get North Korea to the table to commit to denuclearization, even though that is a term that both sides really haven't agreed to in what it means yet?
Well, I am not sure that this opportunity is different. I have previously characterized the state of U.S.-North Korea relations under the Trump administration as defibrillator diplomacy, in that the process comes close to death at various points throughout the year, and the United States jump-starts it again with a big shock of energy through summit diplomacy, but it hasn't treated the underlying diseases that cause the process to come to the brink of failure again and again. So I would have a lot of concern that the United States remains not flexible enough and not creative enough to really make the most out of any opportunity with North Korea.
If we step back and look at a more regional aspect of it, Seoul has announced that it is going to end the intelligence sharing agreement it has with Tokyo. What do you see as the implications of that agreement coming to an end?
Well, first of all, there are the practical implications that South Korea and Japan will no longer be able to share critical intelligence regarding North Korean missiles and other key security considerations directly. But more broadly, it sets an extremely dangerous precedent because previously, for many years, Korea and Japan had to count on the fact that the security relationship between the two countries would be shielded from bilateral political tensions and treated more pragmatically than other areas of the relationship. And this marks a real turning point, and it sets a precedent that, you know, security cooperation can be held hostage to broader tensions.
Hasn't that always been the case between Seoul and Tokyo? If we take a look at this agreement that is coming to an end, it was going to go into place several years ago during the Iman Bak administration, but when he visited Dokdo, which is a disputed territory that Japan also claims as Takashima, that deal was scrapped. So is the politicalization of these type of agreement anything new?
Well, that's a great point. I think this particular agreement has been so high profile that it has always contained some sort of political elements, but the United States has worked hard to make trilateral security cooperation very pragmatic. Scrapping this JSOMIA agreement now really hampers the progress that we have made in the last few years.
Mintaro Oba is a former U.S. State Department official under the Obama administration joining us on the phone today. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Coming up, the U.S.-China trade war means changes to some businesses in the United States. This is VOA Asia.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA Podcasts a try.
VOAnews.com.
Visit our website at VOAnews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA Podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
This news from VOA Asia: sexual violence carried out by Myanmar security forces against the country's Muslim Rohingya minority was so widespread and severe that it demonstrates intent to commit genocide as well as warrants prosecution for war crimes and crimes against humanity. That according to a UN report on Thursday. VOA Asia continues. The continuing trade war between the U.S. and China may be causing businesses in both countries extreme anxiety. But the trade dispute is good news for businesses in other countries, as many companies have or are moving their manufacturing away from China. VOA's Elizabeth Lee has details on why Vietnam is attractive to one company in Southern California.
The headquarters of Pedego are in constant motion. The company designs, assembles, and markets its own electric bikes. 80% of its bike parts used to come from China, but not anymore.
Now we're probably 70% in Vietnam and 30% in Taiwan.
Pedego co-founder Don DiCostanzo says he had already been planning to expand to factories in Vietnam because of the threat of high European Union tariffs on Chinese-made electric bikes. So when the U.S. imposed tariffs on a long list of Chinese-made goods last year, including electric bikes, he was ready.
We then were immediately able to accelerate that production, and we began producing bikes in Vietnam for this country in September, right after the tariffs went in place. And by January 1, we had eliminated all production in China and managed to move all of our production and supply chain to Vietnam.
Pedego is not the only company moving manufacturing away from China because of the trade war. Kevin Clowden is the executive director of the Center for Regional Economics at the Milken Institute.
The two countries that are benefiting the most are Vietnam and Mexico. They are benefiting because of the ability to take advantage in terms of capacity and because of their geography, and everybody else is looking at them with envy.
When comparing the first half of the year for 2018 and 2019, the dollar amount of imported goods from Mexico increased by more than 6%. Imports from Vietnam rose by more than 33% in that same time frame. Don DiCostanzo says moving to Vietnam was a good decision.
So it's been a great experience. We're getting better quality out of Vietnam.
DiCostanzo is a part of a coalition that will be pushing for congressional legislation for a 10-year exemption from all tariffs for bicycle components. If that happens, bike factories may start popping up in the U.S. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Fountain Valley, California.
This news break from VOA Asia. Indonesia says it's blocked internet access in unrest-hit Papua New Guinea over fears that a stream, Papua Indonesia, over a stream of offensive and racist posts online that sparked violent protests. This is VOA Asia. A three-year study by 13 leading malaria and public health experts finds malaria eradication is feasible, but it'll take new tools, political commitment, and a lot of money to achieve. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The concept of malaria eradication is not new. It has been around since the mid-1950s, when the World Health Organization launched its first global malaria eradication plan. Though that and subsequent efforts have failed to rid the world of the deadly, debilitating disease, experts say malaria eradication is feasible. They say there is no biological barrier to its elimination. The director of the WHO's Global Malaria Program, Pedro Alonso, says achieving that goal would involve improving primary health care and access to services, and better use of data and surveillance systems. But the key to eradicating malaria, he says, is accelerated research and development of new tools.
We need a re-energized research and development effort to develop the knowledge base, the strategies, and the tools, be these vector control tools, drugs, improved vaccines, or other technologies, that will allow us to walk the last mile or even accelerate our road to eradication.
Global malaria infection and death rates have remained virtually unchanged since 2015. The World Health Organization reports every year some 200 million people are infected with malaria and about 400,000 die.
Lisa Schlein reporting from Geneva. You've been listening to VOA Asia. Get our program on iTunes and SoundCloud, download our podcast, and take VOA Asia with you. Our thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, Nelson Lopes, and our Facebook team, Diane Gao, Jim Stevenson, Skylar Ogden, and Keith Lane. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Have a great day.